The views and opinions expressed on this show are those of the sponsor, Gross & Schuster.
News Radio 92.3, informative, local, dependable. It's the Pensacola Expert Panel. I'm your host, Jake Walker. My guest joining us on the phone this morning, Terrence A. Gross of Gross & Schuster. Go to grossandschuster.com or give him a call here in Pensacola, 434-3333. Mr. Gross, are you there with me on the line?
Yeah, I'm here. Glad to be here as usual. And I got a question for you, Jake, rather starting Block. I had a few radio shows. I'm trying to remember our last show, whether I talked about jury selection on this station or not.
You did?
I did, then I have another topic. Okay, good. Mm-hmm. Well, then I'd like to follow up.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought I did. So thank you for that. Yep. So now you've been picked. Now you've been picked, and you're one of the potential jurors. And I explained last week that there's seven people. Usually on most juries, unless it's like, a death penalty case. But I'm talking about, most criminal cases, most personal injury cases. That's what I do. We call those civil cases because it's about money. You have seven. One's the alternate, but they don't let the alternate know who the alternate is. So they'll pay attention. And then before the jury goes back to deliberate, they release the alternate. But if someone gets sick in the middle, or someone's loved one dies, then there's at least an alternate there so the trial can go on and you don't have to retry the case. So there's seven people in the box. The first thing the jury's going to hear is opening statements, and I'm going to call it opening statements. I've heard some lawyers call it opening arguments, and I think that's a misnomer because a lot of judges forbid a lawyer from arguing their case in opening. They want opening to serve as a roadmap, a sketch, a diagram of what's going on here, what they're should hear, and what the evidence will potentially show, and so forth. They don't want it to become an argument, a slugfest, and whatever. And a lot of times there will be objections. I object, Your Honor. Mr. Gross is arguing his case, and most judges will sustain that and say, Mr. Gross, just get back to telling the jury what they should expect and quit arguing your case. So I have seen books called Opening Argument. And again, at least in Florida, I can't tell you about other states, but Florida looks down on arguing your case. Now, again, you can be assertive. There's ways of doing it if you're artful. And basically, what I've learned over time is if I start a sentence like this, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I predict the evidence will show that the defendant was totally at fault. Well, I've kind of argued, but since I said the evidence will show, I'm going to get away with it. So long you're portraying what the evidence will show. So, the jury knows nothing about the case when they're picked. And then they're going to learn it's a car wreck. They'll probably learn where it happened, when it happened, and then what were the person's injuries and doctors and so forth. They'll learn, some of these facts. And there may be some discussions of how the law applies to the facts, but you're just not allowed to get in there and argue per se. Some lawyers get away with it. Depends on the judge. Depends how they couch their remarks. But that's just part of it. Then we get to the actual evidence. Now, does the jury get to hear all the evidence? And the answer is no, because of a lot of things. There's rules that regulate trials. And I think I mentioned on a prior show that whoever got the ticket is usually not admissible. So certainly your client would love to blurt out in a contested liability case, well, they got the ticket, Well, if they blurt that out, not only will that person's lawyer get chastised by the court, it may lead to a mistrial and the whole jury may be thrown out. And the judge says, well, you screwed up. It's a mistrial. Come back in 6 months and we'll try to pick another jury. And the judge will really frown on that, a waste of time and resources. Sometimes, depending on how bad it is, either the claimant or the lawyer could be found in contempt of court. There's also motions that are filed before court, and they're called motions in limine. Motions in limine to limit what the evidence can be presented. And you're saying, well, that sounds unfair, but let's say this. Let's say I'm representing Joe Smith. And Joe has a car wreck, and he's had neck and back pain. He's had injections and all these kinds of stuff. Would it be fair to bring in the fact that Joe was arrested for possessing a half a pound of marijuana 20 years ago? I mean, what does that have to do with the price of eggs? It's just character assassination. So a good lawyer will file a motion in limine and say, Judge, the prejudice of that evidence is so remote and so prejudicial, it outweighs any potential relevance. And I'm sure 99.9% of the judges in that case would tell the other lawyer, do not bring that up. Sometimes whatever it is, there's things that are just maybe slightly relevant. The fact that maybe the claimant was a victim of spouse abuse in a prior marriage 11 years ago. The judge may say, well, that was so long ago. That's not for the jury to hear. That's just a bunch of white noise. I'm going to grant the motion in limine, and you're not to present any evidence that this person may have been physically accosted by a prior spouse 11 years ago. Now, every case is based on its facts. Every motion is based on its facts. Now, in the middle of my case, if there's a spouse abuse in the middle and the guy uses his wife as a punching bag, that may be relevant because are the injuries from the car wreck? Or are they from the fact that he punched her in the face, broke her nose? And of course, that could have hurt her neck as well. So it just depends the timing and what are the facts, and the judge has to weigh that. But he's usually using the scale. There's a rule. It's rule 90.403, that says, does the prejudice outweigh any potential relevance? And that's a judgment call for the judge. So, and he makes it before trial. Competent lawyers file motions in limine before. In fact, now with pretrial orders, the judges insist on these motions before because they don't want to delay a trial. Once a trial gets going, they want to run smoothly. You got the jury there. You got a set amount of time. All these motions in limine, something like that, should be heard way before trial. And if it's brought up in the middle of the trial, the judge is going to frown on that and maybe not grant something that normally could have been granted had it been made timely. So there are things like that. We also have something called a collateral source rule. The collateral source rule pretty much says we're going to let the judges deal with maybe third-party payments such as no fault or Medicare or Blue Cross and write-offs and EOBs, all this stuff, and not bother the jury with it. That's the way it's always been. Now, there was a recent constitutional amendment that was passed in March of 2023 that may have changed all that. I have not tried a case yet that occurred after March of 2023. So it's going to be pretty brand new law. And I think every judge is going to differ. And maybe some defense lawyers don't like it because the more math you give to a potential jury, the more chances that you're taking of them screwing something up or misunderstanding. So usually you can show the medical bills, but any deductions, anything set offs is usually done by the judge and with both sides sometimes with briefs. We have briefs, and the judge methodically makes that decision as opposed to off the cuff in the heat of battle in the middle of a jury trial. So we'll see how that goes. So do juries get to hear everything? And the answer is no. When it comes to criminal convictions, the law has long been, and I'm going to make this very clear, if my client takes the stand to testify in a personal injury case, which, of course, I don't see how you try a personal injury case without your client taking the stand, because they're the ones that are going to talk about the pain and suffering the most and this and that and the other. Well, once they take the stand, they're a witness, and they're allowed to ask any witness this two-part question. And the two-part question is this: have you been convicted? Remember the word convicted, not arrested. Have you been convicted of any misdemeanors involving fraud or deceit? If they've been convicted of misdemeanors of fraud and deceit, then the next question could be, how many times? So the person's passed a lot of bad checks and was convicted for 20 bad checks, I guess they would have to testify, well, I was convicted 20 times, and then at that time, maybe their lawyer may even want to bring that out, because maybe a jury will be forgiving of somebody that bounced some checks. But if you leave it in the air like that, they don't know if they stole something or whatever. So it's kind of a dicey situation, and so it's still emotional limit. He could knock that stuff out. If it was so long ago, the judge could still knock it out. But they're allowed to ask either, have you been convicted of any misdemeanors involving fraud or deceit? That means if you've got three prior DUIs and they're misdemeanor DUIs, they're not coming in. The jury does not get to hear that. If I'm one of these guys that just has a hot temper, I have a really hot temper, and I choose to use my fist to settle arguments as opposed to words, and I've been convicted of battery three times, that's not coming in. Battery is a misdemeanor, and it's not fraud or deceit. So fraud or deceit would be shoplifting, bad checks, that type of thing. And the other part of the question is, have you been convicted of a felony? Convicted. So you could be arrested. You could actually go to court, and you could plead guilty or no contest. And the judge could accept that plea. And the judge could say the magic words, I withhold adjudication, and put you on probation for 5 years or 3 years or whatever it may be. Well, if he's withheld adjudication and you just pled guilty to a felony, have you been convicted of that felony? The answer is no. You were arrested, you were prosecuted, but you were never convicted, because withhold adjudication means you're not convicted in the eyes of the law. Even if you went to jail, even if you were put on probation, even if you did pay a fine, even if you did have a lawyer, even if you did go to court, the magic part is, were you convicted? And if you're not convicted, then it's not admissible. So you have to be convicted of a felony, and if so, how many times? And again, if the felony is very remote, if it was back to a half a pound of marijuana when you were 18 years old, and you're now 40 years old, and that was 22 years ago, I'm going to guess and go on a limb and say 90-something% of all judges would probably say, that was 22 years ago. That evidence is attenuated. It's just slightly remotely related. I'm going to grant Mr. Gross's motion in limine, and Mr. Insurance Company lawyer, you're not allowed to present that felony conviction to the jury. And then if he does, it's going to be a mistrial, and then the judge will go, if a person violates a motion in limine, that's even worse, because it's already a judicial order saying, do not bring this up. And if a lawyer brings that up, the judge is going to be very unhappy. And it could be contempt of court, and just depends on the context. And contempt of court, a judge has the right to put a lawyer in jail. or fine the lawyer, and certainly, declare a mistrial, which simply means that the case has to be started all over again, probably 6 months later, on a new trial docket with a new, jury to pick and all that. So anyway, these are things that go on. So once the people are selected, the judge usually starts with what we call preliminary jury instructions. Just gives them a little bit of rules of the game. And there's a book, so most of it's pretty standard, but there are some deviations. Some judges allow and want jurors to do note-taking. They even pass out yellow pads and a pen. Here's a yellow pad and a pen. Take notes. But just because somebody's written this down, when you go back to deliberate, doesn't mean the rest of you have to rely on what they wrote down. So there's very specific. We have a book of jury instructions. So 95% of all jury instructions are standard forms with a few deviations depending on the case. But and again, those have to be submitted, by the lawyers beforehand. So usually before the trial begins, the parties have already agreed to jury instructions for the most part. So the judge will give the preliminary instructions. Then the plaintiff gives their opening statement, not argument. Then the defendant is allowed to give his opening statement. And then the plaintiff begins presenting their evidence. And then they'll start with witnesses. And a lot of times they begin with the plaintiff. That's a strong witness anyway. So most lawyers want to start at a high point, and they call their person. And that person certainly discusses the accident, then discusses their injuries and treatment and all these other things. So that would be part of it. Then, of course, after each witness, the defense is allowed to cross-examine. And the courts give a lot of leeway to cross-examination. So they're allowed to cross-examine, and then the plaintiff can get up and do a redirect and maybe try to cure any problems that may have arisen on a cross-examination, and then they're released. Then the next witness, and it could be an eyewitness to the wreck. Sometimes we actually call the defendant. We may either call the defendant, or sometimes if we took a really good pretrial deposition of the defendant, we are actually allowed to read all or part of a defendant's deposition to the jury. And then towards the end of the plaintiff's case, before they rest their case, they present the medical part. And a lot of the medical in this day and age is done by video deposition, because a lot of doctors just don't have the time to go to court because, even when you're picking a jury, it's hard to say exactly, is the case going to run smoothly? Is it going to run slowly? And just trying to get your expert lined up as to when they're going to testify is not always transparent, because the witness that you thought was going to take an hour to present could take 2 hours. You don't want to have a neurosurgeon or orthopedist sitting outside in the hallway for a couple hours at wherever they charge $600 an hour, and they're getting mad because they're waiting. And so a lot of times what we do is we go before the trial to the neurosurgeon's office, to the orthopedic surgeon's office, to the pain doctor's office, and we take a video deposition. And what my first question usually is, so here we are in video. My first question to the doctor is always usually the same. Doctor, could you please state your name for the ladies and the gentlemen of the jury? And I may have done that 2 months before trial. So it is a perpetuation. It's called we're perpetuating the testimony. The judge will give a jury instruction. And it'll say, just because this doctor wasn't physically present, do you promise to give as much weight as if the doctor were here live in court. Of course, we got video, and there's nowadays with modern courtrooms, there's 3 and 4 monitors, so you're seeing the doctor. I'm there asking questions. The same insurance defense lawyer is there cross-examining the doctor. So that's what's done. And then some medical doctors or medical witnesses sometimes come live. It just all depends. But your average practitioner, if they're a practicing doctor, they rarely go to court. They're just not, they don't want to go to court, and they're going to charge you many times more because they have to, you know, like everybody else, they got to drive to court, hope to find a parking spot, go through security, come up, and then maybe wait an hour or two versus taking it in their office. You're set at 3 o'clock. It begins at 3 o'clock. And all that. And then when it ends, you leave and they can see their next patient and all that. So it's just more efficient for the doctor. And so that's why a lot of them don't testify live, but you'll get to see them and count that. And then after the plaintiff has finished their case, then they rest their case. Now the insurance lawyer is allowed to present their case, and then the plaintiff could cross-examine their witnesses, and they usually may not have that many. It may be the defendant. It may be a defense medical expert. It's called a CME, a compulsory medical exam, where they've either examined the plaintiff physically or just gone over the records, and they come up with a different opinion. We don't think this accident caused all these problems. We think this person had a pre-existing condition, and that's why they had the surgery, not because of the accident. And then it becomes a jury question. As usual, I can see, Jake, that we're quickly running out of time. I'm always looking at my clock here,
right?
And I see we're quickly running out of time. But this has been Terrence Gross. I'm a local personage lawyer, been here for 44 years. As Jake said at the opening, our phone number is 850-434-3333. I'm in practice with my 3 sons. We have 5 offices throughout the panhandle, and probably the best way to find out more about us is on our website at grossandschuster.com. Look at our reviews. Our reviews tell a lot. Look at some of the advertising lawyers' reviews and compare those reviews. You'll see a tremendous difference. So anyway, I appreciate the opportunity to get up and discuss things and hopefully educate people. If they ever find themselves in a jury trial, they'll have a little bit of an idea.
Yes, and thank you for doing this, because I got my first jury summons earlier this year, and I didn't know what to expect. I had no idea, and I was really nervous. I was kind of scared, because you never know what you're walking into. So thank you for shedding some light on this. And if anybody has any questions, follow up, let me know, 437-1620. Terrence A. Gross, thank you so much, sir.
Dependable traffic on the fives, weekdays on News Radio 92.3, WNRP, Gulf Breeze, Milton, Pensacola.